Welcome to Watchmen on the Wall, a daily outreach of Southwest Radio Ministries and SWRC.com. God is still on the throne, and prayer changes things. Today, we get a preview of the latest issue of the Prophetic Observer newsletter, and Boyd Severs is back to continue his look at warfare in the Old Testament. Friends, we need your help. Summertime giving is always slow, but this year, with the upcoming election and the economy, giving is at a critical level. Unfortunately, we're having to cut expenses even more, including reducing the number of radio stations we're on. Simply put, we need your help. Please be praying for Southwest Radio Ministries. Ask the Lord to provide the needed funds so that we can continue to proclaim the good news. And as you're led, would you please consider giving a gift? Your one-time and monthly gifts are needed this month. You can give when you call 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. You can also give at our website, swrc.com. Thank you, friends, for your prayers and financial support of Southwest Radio Ministries. Now, here's today's host, Affirm Apologetics Director, Clayton Van Hus.
We're glad you joined us today for the Watchman on the Wall program. I'm your host, Clayton Van Hus. I am the director of Affirm, the apologetics branch of Southwest Radio Ministries. I am joined today by my friend, Dr. Boyd Severs. Dr. Severs is professor of Old Testament at the University of Northwestern in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he is also a member of the Shiloh Dig Team. He supervises a square, and he teaches us about ancient warfare and the warfare that has happened here in Israel at Shiloh. Dr. Severs, it's so good to have you here on the program.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, it's great. By the way, we are coming to you from the land of Israel. We have been here digging at Shiloh, finding fascinating things. We're going to talk about some battles maybe that took place there. Dr. Severs is the author of the book Warfare in the Old Testament, The Organization, Weapons, and Tactics of Ancient Near East Armies. It took me a second to get that out.
Yeah, it's kind of long. I'm sorry about that.
It's a great title. It's a great book. And something I didn't mention on the previous program is the art. So you have two different kinds of art in your book. This book has pictures.
And some of them are color.
I know.
It's fun.
That's what's great about it. Actually, an artist whose work I've enjoyed in military books, Angus McBride, you've got some of his art in there of ancient armies. Mm-hmm. But who was the other artist?
Well, I do have some beautiful color illustrations by Angus McBride, as you mentioned. And then I wanted to do a lot of other line drawings, simpler drawings. And I wanted to highlight certain things, so I needed an artist that I could work well with. And my son, my oldest son, Joshua, was an art major at my school at that particular time. And so we have similar interests. And so I would say, Josh, here's this thing, and I want you to highlight this and leave that out. And so he did, I don't remember, 80 line drawings or something. So he's in there quite a lot, and it's a better book because of his work.
Yes, I agree. He did a great job. Your book, I have found, is very easy to use in research. I mentioned in the previous program that I've used it multiple times, and it really is. It sits on my shelf right behind my chair as I sit at my desk, and I turn around and pull it off of there often and go through it. It's an excellent book, an excellent resource, talking about warfare in the Old Testament. We've talked a little bit on the previous program about how warfare worked in the Old Testament and how the people of Israel, there were professional soldiers, but they were preceded in earlier times by more militia types. And then you would have in the future, of course, you'd call up your militias as well to go with your standing army. But ancient Shiloh, where we dig, and this is such an important site in the Bible, you said that there's evidence that we have found of three separate battles, one of which is alluded to in the Old Testament, I think in Jeremiah 7:12. Mm-hmm. That's kind of our theme verse for the dig at Shiloh. Go now to my place at Shiloh, where I first set my name. And God says, see what I did there. And you know, if I didn't spare them, I'm not going to spare Jerusalem.
Right.
So he alludes to something bad happening. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening here?
Well, the ark was lost in the battle at Ebenezer down on the coast about 25 miles away. a very difficult time and some poor decisions by some of the major Israelites who were there, and they lost the ark. And then when the Israel finally got the ark back after God makes certain actions happen, it doesn't go back to Shiloh. And why wouldn't it go back to Shiloh? Logically, because Shiloh had been destroyed. The Bible doesn't mention it being destroyed, but it does allude to it later on, as you mentioned in that passage from Jeremiah. When it's time for the temple, leading up to the time for the temple to be destroyed, and people say, you know, it can't ever be destroyed, that's God's house. And God says, no, I let Shiloh be destroyed, so why can't the temple in Jerusalem be destroyed? It got destroyed at that time. Our dig, and especially an Israeli dig in the 1980s, found a destruction layer in about the middle of the 11th century, so somewhere around 1050, 1070 BC. Somebody destroyed the place, and very logically, it was the Philistines. After they defeated the Israelite militia at Ebenezer, then they knew the country was defenseless, so they went up to the de facto capital where the religious center was. The Israelites couldn't defend it well at all, and so quite logically, the Philistines destroyed it at that time.
Sure. Shiloh is not a large place.
No.
No, it's a little hill.
Yes.
And it had some massive walls at one point.
At one point.
But at the time of this destruction, Samuel was a boy, or he was there. Eli was the high priest, mm-hmm. and I guess you could almost call him the president, but...
The leader. People would look to him as the leader of the nation.
His two sons were killed in battle with mm-hmm. the Philistines mm-hmm. when they took the ark. The Philistines come in to take the capital.
Mm-hmm.
How did the Philistines fight? What kind of weapons did they use? What were their tactics? Who were these Philistines?
Well, they were people who had come from the Aegean, or more toward Europe, in the area of Greece. Today is how I think of it. And they had a very strong and effective military. They came in and they were the nemesis of Israel, because Israel had a weak military for most of that time up until David. And so the Philistines could push the Israelites around as much as they wished, almost all the time. And so at this point, they come up into the hills, and we know that the Philistines had chariots, but chariots are more difficult to use up in the hills, so I don't know if they brought chariots up for this battle, but they would have come up, and they had archers. They would logically have had slingers, though I'm not sure about that. They had nice metal weapons. In fact, the type of sword in the region seems to have changed with the Philistines and the related peoples, whereas before they had a sickle sword that was curved like a sickle that you harvest with, that was sharpened on the outside instead of the inside. It was a slashing weapon. Whereas it seems that when the Philistines came, they brought the straight double-edged sword like we think of as swords. Mm-hmm. And so that happened with them. So they had very good weaponry, and we have, I think, three examples of their weaponry at Shiloh. In our excavations, again, in just a small section at the one end of the hill, we have three arrowheads, and they don't say made by Philistines or anything on them. What they have is a typology. They're made in a certain style. Styles often, but not always, can be dated by that particular style, and these three are well made and seem to be from the time period of the early judges, which archaeologists called Iron Age I. And since they're so nice and date from that time period, usually the Israelite material culture is not very nice, and so I think it highly likely that those three nice arrowheads would have belonged to the Philistines. And then last week, in our dig, we also came up with another arrowhead that's the opposite. It's poorly made, it's bronze, but it's crummy.
Yeah.
It is not beautiful. I think it's from the same time period, so I'm guessing that one could well be Israelite. So it's three against one, the good stuff against the poor guys.
Sure, sure. And that is a fascinating thing to look at, like the Philistines, how they did things. So what we see then is we see a destruction of Shiloh about the time of Eli, Samuel, and everything that's going on there that matches up with what we understand that at some point God had allowed Shiloh to be destroyed.
Right. So we can't say that these arrowheads did come from that battle, but we can say they could have come from that battle.
Sure, sure. And that's the way that things work. When you're looking at something that's 3,000 years old, you're trying to put together the puzzle pieces, and oftentimes those pieces are distorted, they're twisted, and you're trying to figure it out. But that's a lot of what you're doing there at the site. In fact, I want to talk about what you're really focusing on. But before we do that, there were three battles. We just talked about the first one that we're finding. What's the third battle?
The third battle is that we have found arrowheads that's, I'm going to say, seem to date to the Crusades, but really they are Crusader arrowheads, so they do date to the time of the Crusades. There was a Western Christian kingdom called the Kingdom of Jerusalem for about 150 years. I don't remember the number very well. But there was a particular time period, the first two-thirds of the 13th century, when the Crusaders had enough guys who had come over from Europe that they could go out and make the raids. And that was when they very logically could have raided a place like Shiloh. Shiloh would have been a Muslim village at the time, probably poor and small. And so we have arrowheads. And this type of the type of arrowheads that we have actually are the same type used by the Muslims and by the Crusaders, which I think is really funny. Why would they do that? Are they just all buying from the same guy who made them in Damascus or something? We don't know. So we have arrowheads from the time period. You wouldn't have a battle there between the two armies. There's no reason to go there.
Sure.
So somebody went and raided it. And since it's a Muslim village, it was probably the Crusaders who rode there on horses, rained death upon those poor villagers for a while and took supplies and whatnot.
Right. I recall last year in my square, we found a little piece of iron that was curled, bent on the end, and it was against a wall. And when you looked at it, you said, "This is a Crusader arrowhead." And I was like, "Wow, how'd that get here?"
Right. Why would there be a battle here?
Sure.
And it is unknown. There's no record of a Crusader raid taking place at Shiloh or any kind of a Crusader battle at Shiloh, but that's where it would fit.
Another thing I'm finding this year a lot of is pieces of pottery that have painting on them that are very much Muslim pottery. When you talk about it being a poor Muslim village at the time, I guess that makes perfect sense.
Right. There was a village there. We have a little bit of their pottery. Most of the village was at the southern end of the hill, and we're at the north, so we don't find their buildings.
Right.
But we find some of their pottery. We find a number of their arrowheads. And then we find some of their coins also. We have a beautiful silver coin of Baldwin III, the one king of Jerusalem, and then we find a number of Arab coins, including the time of the 13th century. So things from that period that indicate that there was probably, I'd say a high probability that there was a Crusader raid at that time. Unknown from history, but there here's the evidence, so that it's likely that that was the case.
And that makes sense. We find things. Now, something else that is unknown from history. Okay, so we've bookended, we talked about the Philistines fighting there 3,000 years ago. We talked about the Crusaders fighting there, what, over 500 years ago?
Yeah, a little less
somewhere in there. And now, this is what you're really working on. You're finding evidence of a different battle that was fought at Shiloh that would have been fought just after the time of Jesus, correct?
Correct. A few decades after the time of Jesus, the Jews were under the Romans and were obligated to them and decided they were going to revolt. And so they revolted in 66 AD. It took the Romans a year, but they brought in three legions. And then it took them 3 years to retake control of the whole of the nation. And finally, they had 80,000 guys at Jerusalem to crush the capital and end the second independent Jewish nation. There was a 3-year time when Vespasian, the leader of the army, and then later his son Titus, just strangled Jerusalem and the whole of the country. There's a historian, a Jewish historian, who actually defected to the Romans, who wrote a great deal about the revolt. And so it's a gold mine of information. And so he, with what he describes and some of what we find in the ground, you can see very careful advances of the Romans and when they went to where. Then at Shiloh, there's no mention of a battle at Shiloh in this pretty complete history of that revolt. Thus, in the first year of digging at Shiloh, when my student found a Roman, what I thought was a Roman slingstone, I thought that doesn't make sense because the Romans did not come here. There's no mention of a Roman battle at Shiloh in the ancient records. There's no discussion in modern academic literature, but after 3 years in reviewing all of the finds, especially the military finds, which are of interest to me, the slingstones and the arrowheads demonstrated we had a Roman battle there. which I thought was stunning because here's a battle nobody knew anything about. And now we have just proved it, quite honestly.
This battle fought between the Romans and the Jewish inhabitants of Shiloh. We understand the Roman army. We understand that they are well equipped. They're carrying all sorts of weaponry. They're carrying artillery. Tell us a little bit about their artillery.
So the Romans could make machines that could launch two different types of ammunition, big stone balls, and big fat arrows with iron points on them. They could launch them up to 400 yards away and with a high degree of accuracy. So they could sit out of range of anything the Jews could do and rain death on the Jews at whatever target they were at. And that's what they did at Shiloh as well. We know that because we have ballista balls, even at the far end of the hill. They would have set up south of the southern end of the hill, but they could fire those stone balls clear to our area where we are digging, and we have found 10, something like 10, including 4 this year.
Goodness.
Yeah.
I know 2 years ago, we pulled out a piece of a flint ball. I didn't know what it was at the time. In my memory could be distorted, but I remember this thing, when you look at it, you figured, okay, the whole ball must have been somewhere the size of a small cantaloupe. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, the Romans would fire stone balls about the size of a large orange all the way up to a basketball. But if you're firing basketball, stone basketballs, you need a bigger, what they call them, ballista, and then you're tearing down walls. Usually they would use a smaller version of that, and they would fire balls the size of a, I would say, an orange up to your cantaloupe. For that, you may cause damage, but you want to cause terror and you want to kill people. And so they would fire these balls at the town to start to kill and cause panic.
Wow. So who would the defenders of Shiloh have been, and how would they have been armed?
Well, not very well. It's not a very big hill. And at the time of this battle in the first century, actually it would have been in 69 AD, there's a little question about that, there was no defensive wall around the town. The only time, to my knowledge, that there was a defensive wall was back at the time of the Canaanites or the time of the Israelite patriarchs. And there was a massive, very impressive stone wall, 16 feet thick. I don't know how high it went, but then it just fell out of use. And so the Romans would have attacked a defenseless town. Maybe it had up to 400 people in it. Maybe a third of those could have carried weapons. Mm-hmm. Maybe some of those actually fought to the death, but most would have tried to run when the Romans came at them. And so it was not a fair fight. The Romans had all the advantages, and they would just steamroll the place.
Something interesting we find in that Roman layer, as we call it, that Roman period, we find flints. We find, of course, they're flint tools for sickles and things, but also things that look like very crude spearheads, arrowheads. Are they making these defenders, these poor people of Shiloh, is that what they're fighting the Romans with?
Yes, quite probably. The Romans had, they must have used hundreds of metal arrowheads when they were attacking, but they would collect their stuff after the battle. And we have 7 metal Roman arrowheads in our area, but we only have 1 defender's metal arrowhead, and that was several hundred years old at the time. So they had to be shooting things with their bows. And what were they shooting? And I think, and you've alluded to the idea that they probably went back and you were using bone or old flint and shaping them kind of crudely into somewhat effective points that they would put onto the shaft of an arrow and were firing that. So the best army in the world, and these guys are fighting with sticks and rocks against them.
It must not have been a very difficult battle for the Romans.
No.
How long did it take them to take over?
Well, I am working on this project with a good friend of mine who's a retired U.S. Army colonel, and he estimates it took an hour for the Romans. They marched for 3 hours, maybe 10 miles. They get there, they set up for 10 minutes, and then they start firing and just crush the village from one end to the other, and then maybe an hour to kill 400 people.
People never stood a chance.
No.
That's part of history. That's what we see, though, after the time of Christ. We see the revolt, and we see the Jewish people, the nation here trying to survive. What can the Christian take from this, from your book, from what you've written about warfare in the Old Testament?
I say, number one, life's hard, and there are many difficult things, and God is good, and God is sovereign, but He allows, in my opinion, too many difficult things. You know, He puts us through things to help us grow, and to punish at times. It looks to me like maybe it was time for judgment on the nation. God judges nations, and so if he's going to have so much of the nation killed and the capital destroyed, maybe that was a wave of judgment coming on them. So I see that in the warfare that God is sovereign and he uses bad things, and when he wants to make bad things happen, he will. We need to be able to accept it. Habakkuk was living at a time when he knew the Babylonians were going to come in and they would be God's instrument of judgment on his people. And Habakkuk did not want that. But God said, I'm going to do that. And eventually I will judge them. And so Habakkuk took a breath and said, I'm good. I will accept that. God is going to do it. That's what needs to happen. And so I need to be okay with that. And so I tried to think about life and challenges and messes and political disasters and all of that. Much of it is not good, but God uses it as he needs.
We've been talking today with Dr. Boyd Sievers. Dr. Sievers is the author of the book Warfare in the Old Testament. He is a professor of Old Testament at University of Northwestern in St. Paul. Dr. Sievers, thank you so much for joining us today. This is a fascinating subject and a great book.
Well, thank you very much. I agree it's fascinating. Glad to be able to share it.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for joining us today on Watchmen on the Wall.
The complete two-day conversation on warfare in the Old Testament is now available on CD. Simply call 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. Today's featured resource is Boyd Sievers' book entitled Warfare in the Old Testament. Warfare in the Old Testament helps bridge the gap between the modern reader and the world of the Old Testament by using textual and physical evidence to describe ancient military practices. Boyd Sievers paints a realistic picture of how Israel and the surrounding nations did battle, adding depth and impact to the relevant biblical accounts. Filled with illustrations, this full-color volume explores the archaeological evidence and early writings that shed light on biblical warfare between Israel and its neighbors. Order your copy of Warfare in the Old Testament today when you call 1-800-652-1144. That's 1-800-652-1144. You can also order at our website, swrc.com. Warfare in the Old Testament. Learn the role that religion played in these ancient warfare practices. 1-800-652-1144. The brand new issue of our Prophetic Observer newsletter is ready to head out to mailboxes across the country. With a preview of the articles inside and the topics covered in this issue, here are Pastor Larry Spargimino and Josh Davis.
The Prophetic Observer newsletter is a monthly publication of Southwest Radio Ministries, and here to discuss our latest version is Pastor Larry Spargimino, the host of Watchmen on the Wall. Pastor Larry, I'm glad to spend a few minutes with you today.
It's my privilege to be on and to be with you, Josh.
I know that you've written so many articles for the Prophetic Observer over the years, and it's really always very well received by our listeners and those who receive mail from us. So friends, let me share this with you up front before we discuss the particulars of this version of the Prophetic Observer. You can sign up for our mailing list by contacting us, and anytime you place an order with our ministry, you'll be added to our mailing list. We also have a free new listener pack. You can receive that, and it'll include one of the latest issues of our Prophetic Observer newsletter. You'll be added to our mailing list, and you'll start receiving these in your mailbox every single month. Of course, we also have digital versions of these articles available through the swrc.com website. And Pastor Larry, why don't you describe a little bit about what your article is about in this latest version of the Prophetic Observer newsletter?
Well, Josh, my segment is about what Iran's leaders believe about the end times. What a person, a people, a nation, believes about the end times will determine their behavior. The religious leaders in Iran have an eschatology that makes them dangerous, and I really mean that. We can understand why the Iranian leadership makes so many murderous threats against Israel and the United States. It's their eschatology, the end-time view of their religion. You know, as I was putting this together, I realized this should not be a surprise. As a matter of fact, General Douglas MacArthur, as the supreme commander of allied powers in the Pacific, realized that the dismantling of Shintoism as Japan's national religion had to occur. Emperor Hirohito had to renounce his divine status. So what do people believe, what their religious outlook is, especially what they believe about the end times, is really important. As long as our government does not acknowledge the fact that the energy driving the Ayatollahs is rooted in their end-time eschatology, there can be no reasonable bargaining with Iran. Full stop, close quotes, and so forth. I mean, their religion explains everything. There are two main branches of Islam: Sunni Islam, which is what most of the Muslim world holds to, and Shiite Islam, which is Iran's brand of Islam. They are pointing out, and I'd like to mention as I close, that there is a prophecy in Jeremiah 49 that leads many to think that within a generation, Iran will be a Christian nation. When we pray for the peace of Jerusalem, we also need to pray that the Lord Jesus Christ will show up and come in power and glory to the land of Iran.
Amen, Pastor Larry. Thank you so much for sharing that. Friends, Pastor Larry is just describing some of the content, and there's much more to his article as included in our latest Prophetic Observer newsletter. If you don't currently receive this monthly newsletter, you can do so free of charge by getting on our mailing list. Anytime you place an order with our ministry, anytime you give a gift of support to our ministry, you're added to that mailing list, and you will begin receiving this every month in your mailbox. And we are glad that we can send this information out to you. And if you'd like to get our free new listener pack that includes one of our recent Prophetic Observer newsletters, you can do so by calling us at 1-800-652-1144. So friends, we want to thank you for being part of this ministry and partnering with us together. Pastor Larry, thank you for sharing these few minutes with me today.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Warfare in the Old Testament by Boyd Sievers helps bridge the gap between the modern reader and the world of the Old Testament by using textual and physical evidence to describe ancient military practices. Order your copy of Warfare in the Old Testament today when you call 1-800-652-1144. You can also order at our website, swrc.com. Warfare in the Old Testament, 1-800-652-1144. Tomorrow, Billy Crone will share his insight into the frightening rise of the Nephilim. Be sure to tune in on your favorite radio station by downloading our SWRC mobile app or by subscribing to our daily Watchmen on the Wall podcast. Watchmen on the Wall is a production of Southwest Radio Ministries and is supported by faithful listeners like you. Visit swrc.com.